Barakim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to another edition of Business Matters with me, your host, Alameen Templeton, on this wonderful day of Yom Al Atsulata. Yes, it's Tuesday already. My, how time is flowing, how time is fleeting. This time and next week, inshallah, where will we be? Getting ready for Taraweeh Salah. Alhamdulillah! Alhamdulillah! The masajid are going to be full again that night. Such a wonderful thing to see, you know. It kind of like makes you think, what are we missing out on the rest of the year? Where do all these guys come from? Yeah. It's that time of the year again. It's a time for the hunger and a time for the feasting. Get a little bit hungry during the day and then we feast at night. We feast on Noor. Nighttime is a wonderful time to make ibadah during Ramadan. Wow. But nighttime ibadah during Ramadan is unlike any ibadah during the rest of the year. At least that's the way it seems to be for me. You just kind of like get this energy and can just keep on going and going and going and going. 3 o'clock in the morning comes along and you're still hungry for Quran. It's fantastic. Alhamdulillah. Well, there's been all kinds of other things going on in South Africa today. And let's just go and have a look at the tail of the tape, as they say. The tail of the formal economy in South Africa. The formal economy in South Africa. The corporate economy in South Africa. How are the corporations doing? I wonder if we can get a human economy in South Africa. I suppose, you know, in many ways, the informal economy is a clan economy. It's a family economy. It's not an individual economy. It's a family economy, the poor economy, the informal economy. The informal economy is always dependent on help, people helping each other. And the informal economy, if it is a family, extended family economy, then it's probably the more efficient economy. Because your basic costs are shared and your living costs are shared. You know, you're living out of your brother's pocket and your uncle's pocket and your father's pocket and his, and they, of course, all living out of your pocket. You know, there's always arguments about who's got my drill and who's got my lawnmower and who's got the, you know, when you got a really good family ties, there's always arguments about these things. Allah Ta'ala gives us family because, you see, family is very different from friends. Family is very different from friends. You know, you can just ditch your friends when they annoy you. I'm out of here. I'm leaving. But you can't do that to your family. Allah Ta'ala gives us family to keep our hearts soft, you know, because you give so much, you give so much, and then they betray you. They steal, they rob, they lie. And you hate them. And you want to have nothing to do with them. And your heart hardens. And then, you know, the years go by and you see the faces and the heart, you know, forgiveness enters in and your heart softens. So your family does that to you. It squeezes your heart and it softens your heart and it hardens your heart and it softens your heart. Gives you exercise. Makes you emotionally fit. That's what family does. Family. A basis for the economy. Extended family economy will lower living costs and will raise living standards. It will mean that a country can afford to move to a lower wage potential and so, through cooperation, is able to compete with other nations. Or maybe instead in the new world, perhaps there won't be competition between nations. The measured success of nations will be determined by their measure of cooperation with other nations. Now, if you look at the way America's going, the way China's going, it's always easy to bash America over the head with a big stick that it carries around all the time. But China, 2 million Uyghurs in internment camps, re-education. Can you imagine that? The Chinese communists who had such cultural cringe that they had to go and bother and borrow an intellectual fraud from the West. Capitalism and communism, they're like the two-headed monster. China went and had to go and borrow that from the West and then try and impose it on itself. You know, I reckon, you know, stick with what you know, China, and leave the nonsense, Western nonsense. I mean, look where they are now. It's supposed to be a communist state, but in actual fact, it seems to be more capitalist than the United States. Many of the things that would not have been allowed by Mao Zedong in the Cultural Revolution, the Great Leaps Forward, that ended up killing millions of people, starving them to death because of economic theory. But like the British, you know, in India in the 1840s and 50s, Bengal famine, huge big famines across India, all because of intellectual theory. You know, and when people die, instead of feeling sympathy, people say, oh, well, you see, you weren't competitive enough. Or they say things like, you see, the fittest survive. They say that's evolution. Oh, that's market forces. It isn't. A lot of us sends crime into a community only because they don't take care of their poor. And that's it. Zakat, simple. 1.5% of your income, not of your income, of your stored wealth. That's all it requires, really, seriously. Well, also that, and a move away from big state politics, which is, of course, only possible if you change your organizational structure in your economy from a corporation to a clan. Anyway, enough of that. Let's go back to where we were talking about the tale of the tape. What is the tale of the tape saying today? Well, the tale of the tape is saying very mixed signals. The JSE is down, but the RAND is up. Well, maybe it's international investors taking rand profits there. Yay, the rand's gone up. We can go and cash in our single stock futures. We've been holding them. What are single stock futures? Well, it's like it allows you to invest in a country's interest rate as well as the underlying stock. You forego the dividend in the interest of taking the interest rate. The interest rate is far more predictable than the dividend. Well, it also depends on which companies you're investing in. And a good time to cash out is when the rand goes up. So anyway, today the rand is slightly up against all currencies. It's on 14.30 to the dollar, 18.49 to the pound, and 15.99 to the euro. Yeah, so anyway, probably building up ground ahead of the elections. People are talking about, but now will the RAND get a nice little post-election bounce? Bloomberg's claiming that, in actual fact, the tail of the tape says, after most elections in South Africa, the RAND has gone down, but only slightly. Whether or not the elections have a major effect on economic confidence is a matter for debate. Gold price today, still very boring, 1,279.05. I don't expect to see much happening with the gold price in the near future, but then again, you know, the market is always full of surprises, isn't it? The Rogues Gallery, the JSE's Rogues Gallery, the most viewed shares today, Steinhoff in first place as usual, EOH in second place. Wow, it's amazing how EOH has like stayed over there. It's one of the biggest IT and software and hardware maintenance and servicing companies in South Africa, sort of like taking over the role of Dimension Data. Now there's talk about Dimension Data guys from Europe where they want to come over here. It's after Dimension Data was taken over by that big Japanese company, whose name slips my mind at the moment. They're actually talking about coming to South Africa and relaunching Dimension Data according to the old way that it was done. In the old days when Dimension Data was taken off, EOH didn't exist. So, whether or not Dimension Data will be able to take business away from EOH, I suppose, is really the main thing. Not whether or not the old Dimension Data corporate philosophy will work again. It's a very different environment nowadays. EOH, it hasn't been hit to the same extent that Dimension Data was when Cisco decided that Dimension Data was a major retailer of Cisco products. Cisco said, I'm sorry, but we're going to start selling our products cheaper than we're selling them to you. And as a result, people started buying Cisco direct, and Dimension Data fell on its face very hard after that, I must say. It took a very long time for it to recover. I don't know if it ever really actually did. So EOH is there in second place. Sibanya is in third place, and Bluetail. Oh, Bluetail is making a reappearance. That's the company owned by that Bears billionaire, the reclusive Bears billionaire, whose name also kind of like slips my mind at the moment. Bluetail, supposedly one day maybe going to take over Celsius, maybe not. Well, it's down 4.6% today, so it looks like the maybe nots are gaining on the maybe whoobies. Sibanye is down 2.9%, and EOH is also down 2.9%. So it looks as though second, third, and fourth place in the most viewed shares on ShareNet today are all in the rogues gallery for all the wrong reasons. Well, I suppose if you're in the rogues gallery for bad reasons, then those are the right reasons. No, please, we're starting to talk in circles now, Alamin. It's time to move on. Right, fine. Okay, so the top major movers on the JSE, the big winners today, RCL, that's Rainbow Chicken Foods, PNR Foods, all coming up at the same time. Yeah, consumer-focused, both big gainers, up 2.4% each. Into Prop, that's an overseas rate, I think it's invested in Britain, is up 1.83%. Raynet, that's up 1.69%, and Standard Bank up 1.28%. Anglo Platinum down 5.85%. Implat down 5.32%. Anglo Gold down 4.17%. Harmony down 3.28%, and Sibanye down 2.95%. I suppose as it's the main flag carrier of the mining industry, you could say that Sibanye should have been taking the biggest hit, but you could say it has already taken the biggest hits and is in actual fact only the fifth biggest loser today. And there you see all of them, resources companies, mining companies, obviously a position being taken ahead of wage negotiations. Really not lining up for nice wage negotiations in the platinum sector. You've got AMCU, who's received a very big bloody nose from Sibanye. I'm sure Neil Froneman is like getting the handshakes from all his friends all around. AMCU has been removed as a majority union on Sibanye gold mines. Now it remains to be seen if Sibanye can do the same thing on its platinum mines. And whether or not that Lonmin takeover is going to take place, and for how much it's going to take place, is Sibanye downgrading its offer last week. Wanting to move into the platinum sector, but Sibanye is going to be taking over all of the platinum junk that Anglo Platinum and Impala Platinum are leaving behind them as they move over to shallower and thicker ore bodies that they can excavate using the same kind of underground excavators that they're using coal mines, where you have that, they basically carve out, it's a pillar and cavern or something like that, mining, where you just go and mine out a huge big cavern and you leave spaces, pillars, regular pillars, along the way as you go mining out. And so it's a huge, big, spacious environment. It's far safer, it's better ventilated, and there's far fewer risks and injuries involved. Plus, you cut down your costs, and your profits shoot through the roof, which means that Neil Froneman is always going to be the third cousin of the platinum sector. He's always going to be the poor cousin. He's always going to be struggling. But let me tell you, there's a friend of mine whose father always used to say, where there's muck, there's brass. Aye. Well, Neil Froneman understands that. Where there's muck, there's brass. And he's after his brass. But whether or not his heavy-handed tactics are going to win for him and win for the wider sector remains to be seen. Because you see, AMCU will be coming out of... It really is under attack at the moment. The Labour Department is trying to deregister it as a trade union, saying it's not engaging in trade union activity. Well, that's quite amazing, as it strikes me as being the most active trade unionist kind of trade union that we have in the country. Now the government is trying to shut them down. Well, you know, they're not going to be able to shut them down before the wage negotiations in the platinum sector take place. And all of AMCU's members are going to be very aware of that. There must be hostility and animosity building on the platinum mines already. And as for competition between National Union of Mine Workers and AMCU for membership, now that AMCU has been downgraded as it's not the majority union at Sibanye. However, Neil Froneman very cleverly brought that move right towards the end of what was nearly a four-month strike at his mines. By then, workers were, you know, basically on their last legs of 4 or 5 months without any salary. So, are you an AMCU member or are you an NUM member? Well, you know, AMCU hasn't taken us anywhere. There you see, Joseph Mutundwa, you've got to learn. Bread and butter issues will always trump principle. You know, in the end, if you have a really long struggle and you get to the end of the struggle and you don't have anything to show for it, you're not going to be a very popular man. When you decide to go on a strike, you need to go embark on that strike with the firm belief that you are in actual way going to succeed. Neil Froneman said, no, you're not going to succeed. And he built his walls. And, well, Neil Froneman has won, you could say, in terms of Sibanye and wage negotiations there. Joseph Mutundwa is still going for that 2013 wage demand of 12,500 rand minimum per worker. Didn't get it now, didn't get it in 2013. So, is he basically flogging a dead horse? Is it time for Joe to go? Neil Froneman certainly would seem to think so. But I don't think so. I reckon the South African trade union sector would be losing one of the few bright lights that still remain. Most of them have sold out and they're just little management pets. National Union of Mine Workers being a prime example. Will the platinum miners? I mean, Anglo Platinum has been treating its miners really well. Maybe it'll just be all fine fellow, hail, fine fellow, well met, thank you very much, and there'll be, you know, half a morning's negotiations and a wage deal will be finalized. Neil Froneman will then really be the hero of the gold mining sector. Oh, I wonder what's going to happen. Of course, National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, NUMSA, is also very big on the mines. That's because metal workers, you know, construction, headgear, and they're always there mining and welding and fixing things. And, you know, there's all kind of metal that gets used in mining. So, you know, metal workers are there in full force. They're not doing any mining, but they are doing equipment, capital equipment, manufacture, maintenance, and so on. NUM has pulled out of Kasata because it accused Kasata of being a sellout trade union umbrella body about 3 years ago. It's formed its own political party, participating in the elections for the first time this year. That means that NUMSA is most definitely going to have a political axe to grind. Very interesting. Very interesting in the mining sector. Okay, so I guess that's all that we've got time for the tail of the tape for today. Let's get on to some wider news. Less than 2 weeks before what is said to be the most competitive election of the democratic era, South African consumers are about to be hit by the second highest fuel prices on record, a little more than 2% off the peak reached in late 2018. Price of a litre of unleaded 95 octane will jump 54 cents to 16 rand 67. Ah, my eyes are watering just looking at that. And that's going to come in on Wednesday. According to the Central Energy Fund, of course, this is NASARA timing, so you've got up until Wednesday night to the midnight to get some cheap fuel. Yeah. Last month, this wasn't cheap fuel. This was expensive fuel. Now this expensive fuel has become the cheap fuel. Oh boy, you know, you're chasing from one thing to another thing and never getting anything. That's what we're doing. Citing higher international fuel prices, the Central Energy Fund says fuel prices have trumped any kind of small gains by the rand in the period under review. Prices jumped to 1708 in October 2018. So we're not very far from that, are we? We're kind of like 1 month away from it, you kind of like feel, don't you? And that is despite the news coming out today saying oil prices fell thanks to Donald Trump. Well, Donald Trump said that he had called up his friend MBS, what's his name? in Arabia there. Yeah, he called up MBS and said, come on, man. We need oil prices to come down, man. You know, he wants to look like the good guy. But in actual fact, America is the bad guy in terms of the oil prices. Because even when OPEC cuts back on supply in order to try and push up the prices, the American fracking producers just pump out that oil. They just pump it out and pump it out. They're pumping out that oil as fast as they can. They've made America completely oil independent of the rest of the world. That means that America can really enjoy not having to import fuel and lose all of the money bleeding out of its economy like we have to do. The rest of the world then really suffers under high oil prices. So that means that America's competitiveness relative to the rest of the world increases. It's a bit like, backbiting someone. Have you ever considered why would someone want to backbite someone? Especially if the person being backbitten doesn't hear anything. What in effect actually happens is the person doing the backbiting has his status by a chimera, by an illusion. He has his status raised among the people that he's speaking with, you see. Because what he does is he lowers the perception of the other person's status. And when that person's status is lowered among his audience, then his status is by comparison relatively raised. But in actual fact, what's in actual fact happening is the backbiter is in actual fact sinking into the mud. But anyway, right, so this is Donald Trump. He says, we want lower oil prices around the world. Donald Trump doesn't want lower oil prices around the world. Donald Trump would like to have, maybe some lower oil prices in the United States, but he likes to see his oil buddies making a lot of money. But more importantly, primarily from, a big picture perspective, when oil prices are high around the world, then the United States is happy. Not because the United States has become more competitive, but because it has raised its relative status by making other countries less competitive. So, just like a backbiter, this is the role that the United States is playing in the world at the moment. Other oil-producing nations, Britain being the foremost among them, the most desperate among them as well, because the North Sea oil is basically running dry, and has been running dry for quite a while, which is the reason why Britain has been like, the little lapdog of the United States. Every time they come up with another idea to go and kill Muslims, Britain is right there, the Labour Party. Tony Blair was the leader of the Labour Party when they went into Iraq and started all of this nonsense, when they went into Afghanistan and started all this nonsense. You'd think that the Labour Party would have been so ashamed of all of that. So Germany got rid of the Nazi Party. Why didn't Britain get rid of the Labour Party? Well, because, they've still got the Conservative Party, which is even worse than the Labour Party. And it's in power at the moment. Can you believe it? Now, this is supposed to be democracy. Supposed to be rational human beings making a decision. Well, anyway. Donald Trump says, he spoke to Saudi Arabia. Tony shouted loudly while his jet was flying over the country. He spoke to Saudi Arabia and others, the UAE, about increasing oil flow. He says, all are in agreement. Oh, really? Well, so let's go down a little way, shall we? Russia will not immediately raise oil output after the United States ends sanctions waivers for buyers of Iranian crude in May, President Vladimir Putin said this weekend. Excuse me, I got a cough. Excuse me. Oh, don't know where that came from. Suddenly jumped out of the... there you see, it was an announcement. We've got to go for a quick advertising break. Inshallah, we'll be back in just a little while.
You are listening to the voice of Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah.
Assalamu alaikum, welcome back. Well, remember, if you want to phone in, the phone lines are open here in Lanesia. 010-00-11-004, 010-00-11-004, 010-00-11-004. Or you can WhatsApp us messages on 084-786-3132, 084-786-3132. Right. Now, you know the international markets are supposed to be based on supply and demand. You know, that determines the price and so on. Well, the oil price isn't being determined by supply and demand. It's being determined by political vested interests, just as it was back when we saw that huge big prices peaking. I think it was around about $140, $150 a barrel. That was back in 2008. And why was it peaking? It wasn't peaking because of any shortage of oil in the market. It was peaking because of perceptions of oil shortages in the market. And those perceptions were being ably massaged by news agencies like Bloomberg and Reuters. And they were being massaged using an economic theory which had popped up, which is called peak oil. I used to argue against peak oil all the time at the time. But anyway, peak oil was eventually exposed as being just a lot of nonsense and hot air that had been dreamed up not by the oil industry, in actual fact, but by the Reserve Bank governors in the United States. Yeah, that's where peak oil first emerged. Peak oil theory first emerged in the state reserve banks. That's where peak oil theory first started gaining popularity. That's in actual fact where it originated from, not from the oil industry. And the oil price only fell after Bloomberg foolishly, Goldman Sachs. Just same kind of people, really. Goldman Sachs, just before the 2008 American elections, predicted that the oil price was likely to hit $250 a barrel by the end of the year. That caused such a shock that people started looking into why the oil price had been going up, and suddenly the manipulators had to disappear very quickly because you had U.S. elections coming up. And suddenly the oil price fell down to, you know, boom, 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 like around about $40 a barrel. $35 a barrel, I think it even went down to. Can you imagine in 2000 it was at $11 a barrel? I reckon around about a fair price for a dollar of oil has been $25 and $35 a barrel. Given that your cost of pumping it out of the ground is like less than $1 a barrel. Untreated crude oil should be sold for, depending on the quality, you get sweet crude and light crude and heavy crude and, you know, depending on the quality, it should be between $25 to $35 a barrel. I think it's a fair price. But maybe $11 a barrel is in actual fact a fair price. And it's been the United States now. It suited the United States to push up the oil price in previous years, so it's still suiting it now because a United States doesn't have to import all of its oil. Now it has to import none of its oil because fracking has really filled up all of the cracks. But even before fracking, the United States was in a privileged position in that it was an oil producer itself. I think it had to import maybe about 30% or 40% of its oil. And so a relatively higher price would relatively hurt other nations more than it would the United States. Now the United States is also threatening sanctions against Iran, trying to remove oil out of the market and push the oil price up, just as much as it's also going to war with Venezuela and trying to take over the biggest oil reserves in the world. And of course preventing Venezuela from selling any oil. Got a huge big boycott and sanctions against that South American country. And so now politically they are in actual fact removing oil from the market, but it isn't a natural one. We're just going to go for a quick commercial break. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, there you go. Okay, sorry about that. I had a bit of a moment. I was ill last week. I don't know if you noticed. I wasn't here on Monday and Tuesday last week. And I've got a little 3-year-old girl I have to look after nowadays, and she sniffles and snuffles all day long, and Oh boy. Well, anyway, when you get to your 50s, you find it, you take it a bit longer to recover from these things as well. Well, alhamdulillah. Okay, so nowadays, again, it's not supply and demand. It's political manipulation of the market, which is still going on. The United States, sanctions against Iran and Venezuela have, of course, the additional advantage of pushing up the oil price, which means American oil dealers make a lot of money. It means that all of the other countries around the world have to pay a lot of money and so become less competitive, just as we're seeing here in South Africa. So, yeah, I mean, it's not just me that's saying so. Saxo Bank analyst Ole Hansen today said that we are dealing with a market that's not actually short of supply, but it is short due to politically motivated action. And we know how quickly that can be turned around if necessary. Yeah, so there you go. ING Bank says they believe that Saudi Arabia will increase output as soon as May anyway, which they're planning to do. So, you know, Donald Trump said, oh, they're about to raise oil prices. Well, I asked them to raise oil price, and they said yes. Oh, you see, now it looks like a real big wheeler and dealer, isn't he? But in actual fact, he's an evil manipulator. Just like any US president, he's a mass murderer as well. Just like any US president is a mass murderer. Well, yeah, you know. Even JFK. Yeah, very nice guy, you know, back at home. Commerce Bank says they believe the fall in prices just this morning is probably due to the situation of the futures market being currently overbought. Consequently, even small levels of uncertainty can spark a more marked price response. It's not just a Donald Trump moment. However, because the supply situation remains tight, a renewed price rise is probable. Yeah, and I would agree with that. But Russia says they're not going to immediately raise oil output, probably because Donald Trump has asked Saudi Arabia to do so. Putin said we have an agreement with OPEC to maintain production at a certain level, and this agreement is in force until July. So some people say May, some people say July, unless, of course, Saudi Arabia is doing the dirty on all of its partners. So now, you know, oil is holding us to ransom, but there's something else that's holding us to ransom, and that is water. But I suppose we've got to leave that for the news bulletin. Yeah, there's a massive 54-hour water shutdown was planned for today by Rand Water. Gauteng, yeah, Rand Water. A 54-hour water shutdown was planned for today, and then they decided today that they weren't going to proceed with it. Hmm? Yeah. You were warned about that, weren't you? Yeah, well, in actual fact, the only city that told people that the water shutdown isn't going to happen was a city that's unaffected by it. Joburg Water issued its press statement saying, okay, the water shutdown today isn't going to happen. The 54-hour water shutdown isn't going to happen. Johannesburg City informed its residents who were going to be unaffected by the water shutdown. But everyone else that was going to be affected by the water shutdown hadn't been told. But now the water shutdown isn't going to happen. But we're told that it is going to come back. But we're not being told when it's going to come back. So it's like a big surprise, you know. It's a bit like a Eskom a load shedding, you know. It's like here in Indonesia. I don't know. I mean, you get these load shedding schedules that get published in newspapers. I don't know. Maybe it actually increases circulation. You know, like competitions, spot the ball competitions used to do. Now they've got, your local area Eskom load shedding schedules. You kind of like look at these load shedding schedules, and they've got like a little square, like, you know, you can see some guy has been trained on Excel, you know, goes in this. I once worked for South African Tourism. And every time, you know, South African Tourism, I wasn't working for South African Tourism. I was working for a public relations company that was doing work for South African Tourism. Well, in actual fact, I suppose you could say that I was working for the company that was doing South African Tourism's work. And then we used to go around and, to South African Tourism, like once a week, to go once a month, there'd be like a big, a big kind of like book comparison meeting. You know, everyone would walk in there with Excel documents, and you know, people would put up the Excel document on the stage. Yeah, we've got these meetings planned over here, and this project currently, you know, and they've got color-coded projects, and like meeting-colored projects, and like you've got columns all over the place, and you know, it looks like a Technicolor measles outbreak has suddenly hit the whiteboard. And you kind of like sit there and look at this whole confusion kind of thing. And the only guy that knows what is going on the whiteboard is the guy whose actual presentation has been made at the moment. Everyone else kind of like sitting there looking like, you know, it's like, says, like join the docs, dots on my freckled face when I was 5 years old. I had so many freckles on my face. You know, and you're kind of like sitting there looking at you. Eventually, you know, when you're new to it, you're sitting there and you're kind of like sitting, you're trying to figure it out, you're trying to figure it out. And then you start looking around at everyone else in the room around this huge, big table. You know, there's about 50 guys there at the meeting. And no one else is even paying attention. And the guy that's talking on the whiteboard, he's going on, and he doesn't mind that no one's paying. He's been preparing this thing for like 5 years, and he's coming, he's giving his presentation, and then, you know, then everyone else will draw out their Excel sheets, and they'll show their, like, their spotted measles display, and everyone will go, oh, that's very colorful, and, yeah, oh, that's very nice, and, no, you know, we'd eventually leave after 2 hours of spotted measles, Technicolor comparisons, and no one would know what anyone else had said at the meeting. But, you know, we'd shake each other's hands, slap each other on the back, and call each other bra. Yeah, you know. Don't know what happened there, because it was basically South African tourism. It's only about, like, you know, placing regular adverts in foreign newspapers or foreign publications or foreign websites. And gain off on nice little trips every now and then. And that's what South African tourism is. It's just a money-making... Well, it's not a money-making racket. It's a money-spending racket, and they're spending your money. Yeah, but anyway, they do it according to very nice kind of little Technicolor charts, and that's basically what ESCOM's load-shedding schedules look like when you go and buy the Citizen, because you can't get it anywhere else. So the only reason I buy the Citizen, so I can get my load schedules. Well, then actually you'd stop buying the Citizen again, because you can't understand the load shedding schedules. So, like I say, you know. So anyway, yeah, no water situation. It didn't happen today. We still have water. Well. Well, you know, in the kind of strange, kind of crazy, bumbling way that we go about managing our country, I suppose we can say thank God for that. Alhamdulillah. Alhamdulillah, we still have water today. Don't know when they're going to cut it off, but, you know, really, you should be thankful. If you open the tap and there's water coming out, be thankful. Say a prayer to Allah. Alhamdulillah. Yeah, well, I see that journalists are threatening to go on strike. Sure, it's amazing. That's amazing, you know. Their salaries are not getting paid as much, and they're cutting staff, and they're not giving bonuses and things. Yeah, well, that'll teach him a lesson. You know, they used to have a very active trade unionism in journalism circles pre-1994. After 1994, they shut them down. And the journalists didn't mind, because the journalists were getting paid fat salaries. Because, you see, what was happening was management was cutting down the staff levels, giving the remaining staff more work to do, slowly but surely, like, you know, the frog boiling in the pot, slowly heating it up and not noticing, because can't notice changes in temperature gradual. So the frog boils to death. Now the journalists find themselves in that situation. Predatory publishers taking over their organizations, cutting back on the dissemination of ideas, cutting back on the truth coming out of the publications, firing journalists who want to stand up for journalism, and the rest of the crowd that stayed behind did nothing. Now TESOL Black Star employees, you know, that's Business Day, Sunday Times, you know, the basically the white media. They call themselves Black Star, but like it's basically the white media. Even City Press, I mean, come on. Yeah, the white media, you know, now the staff there, like, you know, 25 years. Yeah, 25 years at the weekend, it was 25 years. 25 years after democracy, journalists have decided they're going to go on strike because they want more money. Well, apparently 160 of them have. Apparently, 160 journalists, and they've issued a strike notice. The first strike in South African democratic history by journalists is about to take place. I'm actually watching this with a mixture of chagrin and glee. Because I actually don't think, if you look at the kind of journalism they're producing, I don't think journalists have got any backbones. How can they stand up for themselves, let alone the rest of the country? But anyway, they say that they've gone on strike and they're determined to fight for their rights. Not going to fight for the rights of the readers, but, you know, when it comes to getting a little money for themselves, apparently then they are willing to go the extra mile. Well, alhamdulillah. Here's a little suggestion for the remainder of the show. I'm just going to read it out. It came across to me on Facebook. It seems to have been handed out by an anonymous person. So I don't even know who I should say wrote this thing. I'm not saying that this is my idea of the way the government or the economy should be run or managed or changed. But nevertheless, it's just an interesting idea. So make of it what you will. I'm not giving this my blessing or something, or saying, yeah, you see, this is the way we must go. No, but this is what they're calling the Patriotic Retirement Plan. Following on, Tito Mboweni's suggestion that all workers, when they reach 55, must be forced to retire so that the youth can have a chance. And then Kasato fired back and said, well, then it's time for you to retire because you're 60 years old. Now, Futsek. Well, Tito Mboweni not willing to follow his own advice, but nevertheless, here's someone who's made an interesting suggestion. Dear Mr. President, please find below our suggestion for fixing South Africa's economy. Instead of giving billions of rands to the government that will squander the money on lavish parties and unearned bonuses, use the following plan. You can call it the Patriotic Retirement Plan. There are about 10 million people over 50 in the workforce today. Pay each of them 2 million rand severance for early retirement with the following stipulations. They must retire. That's 10 million job openings immediately, and unemployment is fixed straight away. They must buy a new car. 10 million cars ordered. Car industry fixed straight away. They must either buy a house or pay off their mortgage. Housing crisis fixed. They must send their kids to school, college or university. There, the crime rate is fixed. They must buy 100 rands worth of alcohol or tobacco a week. There's your money in duty or taxes. Well, okay. Well, like I say, it's not my suggestion. It can't get any easier than that. I reckon you can cut out number 5. But maybe not. Why not? In the Nasada want to, alcohol, I suppose, it's a bit like the lotto. It's a voluntary tax for the mathematically challenged. Yeah. And the more alcohol you drink, the more mathematically challenged you become. So it's a voluntary tax. Yeah, the lotto and alcohol. Voluntary taxes for the mathematically challenged. It can't get any easier than that. The writer says, P.S. if more money is needed, have all members of parliament pay back their falsely claimed expenses and second home allowances. If you think this would work, please forward to everyone you know. Also, let's put the pensioners in jail and the criminals in a nursing home. This way, the pensioners who have access to showers, hobbies and walks, and receive unlimited free prescriptions, dental and medical treatment, wheelchairs, etc., they receive money instead of paying it out. They would have constant video monitoring, so they could be helped instantly if they fell or needed assistance, or at least they will not be slotted and growing old in a drafty retirement village. Their bedding will be washed twice a week and all clothing will be ironed and returned to them. A guard will check in them every 20 minutes and bring their meals and snacks to their cell. They'll have family visits in a suite built for that purpose. They'll have access to a library, to a weight room, spiritual counseling, pool and education. Simple clothing, shoes, slippers, pajamas and legal aid will be free on request. Private secure rooms for all with an exercise outdoor yard with gardens. Each senior would have a PC, a television or radio and daily phone calls. There would be a board of directors to hear complaints and the guards would have a code of conduct which would be strictly adhered to. The criminals would get cold food. They would be left all alone and unsupervised. Lights off at 8 p.m. and showers once a week. They live in a tiny room. They'd pay 1,000 rand plus a week. Have no hope of ever getting out. obviously written by someone who's around about the same age as me. Think about this. More points of contention. Yeah, obviously a retiree with a lot of time in his hands. Eh? Cows. Is it just me? Or does everyone else find it amazing that during the mad cow epidemic, our government could track a single cow born in the Rivier Sonder End almost 3 years ago, right up to the stall where she slept? And they even tracked their calves to their stalls. But they are unable to locate 5 million illegal immigrants wandering around our country. Maybe we should give each illegal immigrant coming across the border a cow, and then we'll set the SPCA on them. Well, there you go. Let's just a few more news snippets before going. Top officials, politicians, and businessmen of the ANC are facing tax claims of more than 250 million rand on income earned from Basasa, the services company at the heart of widespread corruption scandal, the heart of the State Capture Commission of Inquiry. The South African Revenue Services has conducted preliminary investigations that may lead to charges of undeclared income, overstated expenses, and other misrepresentations against members of the ANC. Those on the SARS list include Dudu Mayeni, that's the chairperson of ousted President Jacob Zuma's charitable foundation, and former SAA chief executive, a ruiner of the state carrier, Minister of Environmental Affairs Nomvula Mokonyane, former National Prosecuting Authority prosecutors Nomqobo Jiba and Lawrence Mrwebi. Yeah, they were fired last week. ANC lawmaker Vincent Smith and former Correctional Services Commissioner Zach Modise, the guy in charge of the prisons. You see, put him in an old age home. I reckon that's a great idea. Put him in an old age home. Angelo Agrizi, Basasa's chief operating officer, told the Commission of Inquiry into State Capture that's probing corruption during Zuma's rule, the company paid 300,000 rands a month to the former leader's charitable foundation in return for protection from prosecution. Isn't that very nice? Well, actually, you know what? I think Angelo Agrizi should also be chucked into an old age home. Some in Cape Town, I've heard. Really terrible things happening there. There's a brother who does itikaf in Al-Khanka Masjid in Lenese every year. And, he's had one leg shot off a few years ago in a robbery. So he's got one leg. But he's a bright and cheerful guy. Despite his advancing years and advancing problems. And he is basically, because he's mobile, he can hop around on one leg in crutches, he's got to do the bathing, man and woman. Because, you know, you reach a certain stage in your life where you're unable to look after yourself anymore. And you know, they don't have nurses looking after them. They don't have care workers or caregivers. They're basically left on their own. And when that happens, you know, you spend the whole night in the bodily waste because you can't get out of bed and there's no one to hear your call. That's a terrible way to go. Really, 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 really. May Allah have mercy on the elderly in this country. May Allah have mercy on our parents. Ya Allah, have mercy on my parents, for indeed they fed me and clothed me and cared for me when I was young. Well, another interesting thing out today, and that's Huawei, which is basically in the vanguard of the rollout of 5G around the world. United States, Britain and France, of course, becoming highly alarmed at all of this because they'd been hoping to use 5G to be able to spy at will on anyone, anytime, anywhere in the world. And instead, Huawei is going about it. So now they say, no, you can't use Huawei because they'll be able to spy on us. You can't trust these people. Huawei shot back and said, the only reason the United States doesn't want us in its countries because then the United States won't be able to spy on everyone. So get Huawei and the United States won't be able to spy on you. Britain then last week announced that they'd come up with a compromise. And they say that, in actual fact, on non-strategic parts of our network, we will allow Huawei. Because basically, you see, if you don't have 5G now, you're going to fall behind the curve. you fall behind the curve, it's going to be very difficult to get into the front again. So Britain doesn't want to lose its place. It's hoping Brexit isn't going to make it fall calamitously, but it knows that if it doesn't have 5G, it most assuredly will. So Britain has said, we don't care that we're US's lapdog. We are going to go with 5G and Huawei simply because we have to. So now the United States has shot back and it said that, hey, you know what? If you go with Huawei, we're not going to be your friends. We're going to pull out. You've got this thing they call the Five Eyes Intelligence Sharing Network, which is basically the Red, White, and Blue Alliance. United States, Britain, and France. Two others in it as well. May even be China and Russia. Let's see, it's United States, Britain, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. This is supposedly the Five Eyes Alliance, and it also includes France and Britain. So, United States says, if you go with Huawei, you're going to become an enemy. It says it does not see any distinction between core and non-core parts of 5G networks, and it says we'll reassess sharing information with any allies which use equipment made by China's Huawei. It is the United States' position that putting Huawei or any other trustworthy vendor in any part, untrustworthy vendor in any part of the 5G telecommunications network is a risk. So, you know, when American technology is better than the rest of the world, you've got to pay through your nose. When the rest of the world is better than America's, then you're not allowed to use it. Okay, well, we'll leave you with that thought. Jazakumullah for joining us. I make dua that whatever trading activity you got up to today has been profitable. And above all, halal. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.